Hello and welcome to Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. I'm Paul Barclay with a discussion about the future of the past, or rather the future of heritage. The future of how the past is identified, codified, celebrated, remembered, signposted, preserved, or, let's face it, contested and argued about. It's been 20 years since the introduction of the Queensland Heritage Act, and we'll look at the debate around the value of heritage as part of the Out of the Port series presented by the State Library of Queensland in partnership with the Department of Environment and Heritage Protection. And I should say the definitions and regulations around heritage are rather complicated. There's World, Commonwealth, National and State Heritage, and there's different legislation for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander heritage. More personally, there's cultural and ethnic heritage, the old box of photos under the bed, the button jar with its objects of memory balanced on top of a shelf, and that place in your mind where a kiss was stolen or blood was spilled, where your life changed or where something important was hidden away for good. Tonight, an eclectic and encompassing view of what heritage is and why it matters. You'll hear from columnist at the Courier-Mail, Kathleen Noonan, memoirist and journalist Benjamin Law, collector of stories and ABC broadcaster Richard Feidler, and feminist and writer Dale Spender. Your moderator is RN's Kate Evans.
I think we should begin with the personal, and we'll become grander and grander, I think, as the evening goes on. So, Kathleen Noonan, you grew up in North Queensland, and I'm wondering which parts of that environment have ingrained themselves on you in terms of how you understand the past.
I grew up on a sugarcane farm, cattle and sugarcane, and so I'm very much a creature of that. I love sheds, old buildings, things that were purposeful and workmanlike. I love old pieces of equipment. There's not a shed with a rusty roof in Brisbane that I don't love. But I also grew up, all our neighbours were big Maltese and Italian families, and all my friends were. And so it's interesting because I didn't grow up with any stories of their past. And there were sort of these hidden stories. No, they were the sort of the first and second generation of migrant families. I think it's indicative of that migrants come to a place and don't look back. The children all speak English, and you want to get ahead. You want to leave poverty behind. You're always aware that poverty's at your heels. And so I didn't hear any stories of sort of the migrant and the Italian families until recently. And I was talking to a great-grandmother in one of the families, and she said that she came out as a 17-year-old. She ended up having 13 children. And they came out, her husband was a cane cutter, and then he owned his own farm. They lived in a little hut. And she told me that they had their bed was Hessian sugar bag filled with the trash of the cane. And that wasn't unusual. That was pretty normal. Clearly at work, they had 13 children. But these were hidden stories when I was a child. No one talked about that and talked about the poverty. And if you came from Malta, Malta was a rock with very impoverished soil. So when they landed in North Queensland, in fertile soil, they were hugely successful. And I think the other hidden stories that we weren't told and talked about as children were the stories of what were called the Kanaka families, or the South Sea Islander indentured workers was what they were called, but really they were sugar slaves. And they were stolen and brought to North Queensland. And a lot of my friends were children or grandchildren of the South Sea Islanders, but no one mentioned their stories. So I was always aware that there was, you know, the youngest child in a big family, you're always aware of sort of there's something hidden, there's secrets going on. And I was very aware of that. And at Mackay, Rockhampton, I mean, most of those North Queensland regional towns, central and North Queensland towns, are going through a boom time at the moment with the coal industry. And I'm really aware that they're losing a lot. Booms are as bad for a town as busts in as far as losing heritage is concerned. So I guess that's where I come from when it comes to heritage.
Well, Benjamin Law, you're also a Queenslander from the Sunshine Coast. What is it about that place that resonates with you? Is it theme parks? Is it tourism? What does it say to you?
When my parents were splitting up when I turned 12 years old, there was an interesting sort of ad hoc arrangement between my mother and my father. And when I say arrangement, it was very, very sort of improvised. So they tried figuring out who would take us and when, and it was decided that my father would take us every second weekend to hang out. And of course, my father had never really hung out with the kids before, so he was a complete loss as to what to do, and he really needed suggestions. Now, we grew up on the Sunshine Coast, and about an hour and a half north of Brisbane. And the Sunshine Coast is probably most well known for its beaches. And we were a Chinese-Australian family, two parents, five kids. The beach terrified us. We aren't very good swimmers. My mum hates sand, just generally just hates sand. My father just assumed we'd all drowned. He thought that thongs split the toes unnaturally. So we weren't beach bums. The other thing that Sunshine Coast is known for, but it's not something that I advertise quite proudly necessarily, is their theme parks. And though the Gold Coast is very well known for its theme parks, and people travel all over the country to come to Gold Coast theme parks, the Sunshine Coast theme parks are a little bit hokey, but we went to all of them because my dad needed some easy options. So to give you a sample, there were a lot of big things. There was a big cow, there was a big shell, there was a big bottle with a slippery slide going around it, there was the big pineapple, of course, there was a water slide park. I won't name it by name in case there are legal ramifications, but it was closed down because of Legionnaire's disease. There are all sorts of weird things going on as well. Like, there are sort of hodgepodge theme parks where it's like, this has a ride and Australian fauna and all of this other stuff, like show bags tacked onto it just because. And so we'd go to all of these theme parks. So they're very much a part of my growing up experience, growing up in a way where you look back on it and you look back on it with half affection and half just complete cringe at all of what it represents as well. So when it comes to the idea of preservation and the idea of these places within my imagination or within the public imagination, I mean, look, my family comes from a rich history of slightly obsessive compulsive hoarders. So when I look at things to preserve or to keep, part of it is deep down inside myself, instinctively on an animal level. I want to hold on to everything. I don't want anything to change. And the other more practical part of me wants to demolish everything out of existence because I just find it completely horrible and have miserable connotations with it as well. That's when it comes to theme parks, at least.
Now, Richard Feidler, you weren't born in Queensland, so I'd like to concentrate on where you are now. In terms of valuing material culture, tell us about Brisbane architecture and suburbia. I mean, what does that mean to you?
To begin with, to preface this, I only moved here about 7 years ago. And when I was a teenager, I read the biography of Douglas MacArthur called American Caesar by William Manchester. It's an amazing book, and some of the most interesting and vivid descriptions in it are of wartime Brisbane, when MacArthur was stationed at Lennon's Hotel across the river here and had his office in the MLC building, I think it is, which is now the MacArthur Museum in the CBD. And when I moved here, I thought, I'd be really interested with my son, who's also really interested in history, to take him around to some of these places and show evidence of Brisbane's amazing wartime history. And the more I know about it, the more kind of enthralling it is, what happened here, what a wild and crazy place this town was during those years. And there's almost none of it. There's so little of it. It's been concreted over, it's been built over. There's the little MacArthur Museum, which is really lovely and kind of precious. And there's really not much that's left of Brisbane's history at that time. A couple of years ago on my conversations program, I had a guest who was an American. His father was actually one of MacArthur's aides-de-camp during the war years. And he said, I want to go and see that side of Brisbane. I want to see a bit of what old Brisbane was like. And I said, look, you might as well just stay away from the CBD, sadly. You might as well just look. If you want to see something that's interesting and original of Brisbane, you have to see its suburbs. The suburbs are full of these houses which we now venerate, full of Queenslanders and modernist homes, which were built by a whole other generation when Brisbane was a poor city. And it was hot, there was no air conditioning. And they built houses that were original and beautiful and practical and modest and sociable that worked. and are really quite unique. And that's true, of course. The Queenslander was taken throughout all of Queensland. I live in the Gap, which is, you know, 15 minutes from the CBD in Brisbane, which is got a few of those kind of houses, but more of those amazing 50s modernist houses, which are just delightful, these 50s modernist bungalows, which are light and airy and spacious and are fantastic. When my friends in Sydney ask me, what's this place, what's the suburb you're living in like? And I say, it's like Brady Bunch land. It's full of houses that are designed by Mike Brady. And they're lovely, they're beautiful. I feel such a strong attachment to those houses. But as for the CBD, I don't have bulldozer fantasies where I want to chain myself to any buildings in the CBD. I have wrecking ball fantasies. I think the CBD has been ruined. Much of it should go, and we should start again from first principles.
So already, I mean, we're not 10 minutes in and we've got stories about regional industrial heritage, about tourism, about architecture, about suburbia, and that's calling on three personal stories and a sense of what the past means. And Dale Spender, in talking to you about the impact, your sense of heritage, I guess I had a sense of defining you in a different way. And so rather than your personal story in terms of an international political movement and to see where that might take us in terms of heritage. So as a feminist living now in Brisbane, what resonates for you in terms of heritage and our relationship to the past?
Well, my sense of heritage as a woman is pretty well about loss. And I've spent most of my life doing research on lost women, lost voices, lost statues, lost banners, you name it. That's what's happened to women's history. And of course, the real piece de resistance is 1851 in the House of Commons in England, when a group of exclusively male politicians passed the act to make man stand for woman. Now, it's a bit like saying we will legislate for dog to stand for cat, but that's beside the point. And their grounds were that man was a more comprehensive category than women. So I have come from that background of language and literature. And, you know, one of the things I did when I lived in London, I got tired of being told about the fathers of the novel and never being told about the mothers of the novel. And I was told that the novels, the first great woman novelist was Jane Austen. For 2 years, I took off the shelves of the London Library any book that I thought might have been written by a woman. That included hundreds and hundreds of anonymous, by the way. And I actually went through them and worked out whether the likelihood was that it was written by a woman. I got all the women's there. I made a list of the women's novelists. And I found 100 best-selling women's novelists before Jane Austen. Among them was a woman called Eliza Haywood, who wrote The History of Betsy Thoughtless in 1751, which was long before a woman wrote a novel, I was told on many occasions in academic institutions. And The History of Betsy Thoughtless discussed at great length the issues of abortion, and the one that really intrigued me was whether a woman was justified in leaving a husband on the grounds of the fact that he was boring. And she decided... 1751, she decided she was justified in leaving, and I thought, oh my God, she'll be run over by a bus. But no, in 1751, she went on to have the most wonderful life. When I came back to Australia after nearly 15 years in England, and I started looking around at Australian novelists, and I found one called Rosa Praed, who was born in 1855 on the Gold Coast in a tent in the most appalling circumstances you can imagine. At the age of 25, her father remarried and told her that she had 6 months in which to find a husband and then she wouldn't have a home. She married very badly, and her husband took her to live on Fraser Island, and much of what we know about the history of Fraser Island was written by her. Their enterprise went bankrupt. They went to London, and by 1880, Rosa Praed was one of the most celebrated novelists in England. She wrote 40 novels. She was one of the best-selling novels in the British Empire at the time. Her first novel was called Policy and Passion, and it was about a young woman who was married to the Premier of Leichhardt's Land, which was Queensland, and he was a convict. He had been a convict and became the Premier, and he was blackmailed. And so the first novel, that Policy and Passion, and it's about corruption in Queensland politics, which you wouldn't believe. And one of the issues, because she, Honoria, rose across to listen to the sittings in the House, and it's about where the railway line was going to go. And evidently it was going to go like this all up Queensland, depending on who paid for it to stop at their station. So that was that. I walk around Kangaroo Point on many an occasion and wonder, was she here? Did she row over there? Where was the house sitting at the time she wrote these wonderful books? So for me, it's about loss and recovery. That was my long answer. I won't. The rest will be short.
But also a powerful reminder of the way in which heritage is not just about either material culture or heritage places. It can be much more amorphous than that, and also given that we are in the State Library, of course, it can be about document-based heritage. But Kathleen, you wrote about this project and you wrote about heritage in your column on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And you were specifically asking your readers to respond to you about their sense of heritage and place and so on in Queensland. So what did they tell you? What was mattering to people?
Every time you write about heritage or a heritage issue, and usually it's about saving something in Brisbane, you get hundreds of emails. You are always shocked when it's about something specific that there's an ignorance about our city. You know, you'll tell people we're about to lose something and they'll say, really, I didn't know that. I didn't know that place. I'm astounded by that from someone who doesn't come from Brisbane. They felt that way about Yungabar under the Story Bridge. People just said, I've never knew anything about that building at all. Never saw it, never went under there. So that's the first thing. I'm always astounded by how much people don't know about their city. The second thing was, there was a couple of disappointing emails, I have to say. There was a couple of readers who said, look, what does it matter? We're going to be filming it all. It's all going to be virtual. You'll be able to walk 3D through any place, any site, any building. We don't need the real thing. We're just going to have virtual. And so what does it matter? I'm hoping they were tongue-in-cheek. I'm going to have to send them a very terse email in reply, I have to say, and put them on the right track. Other readers were talking about specific things like the Valley Rattler, the train that goes to sort of to Gympie, the steam train, one of the few left in Queensland. And they haven't got funding under the last, since the government's come in. And they've had a problem. They need about $1 million for their infrastructure and they can't get the funding. And they were talking about the loss of skills to be able to drive steam trains. They had trained up a factory fitter to be able to work on those sort of pieces of equipment. That larger world of artisans and stonemasons and the loss of skills to keep those sort of things going. Most people who emailed see heritage as buildings and sites. There's often a sense of hopelessness. What can we do? It's okay if you can give them a deadline to send submissions to try and stop something, but there's a sense of what can we do against government. And I believe you've really got to mobilise. You've really got to think like... I mean, people who are interested in history are usually really nice and they're very polite and they think, if I send a very angry letter to the minister, he'll see that, the folly of his ways and he'll reverse that decision. And it doesn't happen that way. And governments and corporations play really dirty. And I find people who work in a historical, the heritage areas are just too nice for them. And you've got to get mean. And you've got to be like the 23-year-old who did that online campaign against Alan Jones. You've got to think like that. You've got to hit them where it hurts and you've got to think about who do I target to stop this happening. I think the digital world holds some really great answers for saving heritage, but yes, lots of very nice readers.
Well, perhaps one way to talk about this then is to use a case study. And Benjamin Law, I know that you've got one that you've thought long and hard about, and that's Stefan's Needle.
Oh, God. OK, so Stefan's Needle, let's go back to 1988 when Brisbane was in the throes of World Expo, and I was very excited about this. I was 6 years old and would make regular trips to what's now South Bank. And Brisbane was alive, and it felt like the whole world was on our doorstep, and every pavilion was another country, and you had your little passbook, and you had your little platypus backpack and cap, and it was all very, very exciting. And of course, one of the monuments that was a part of World Expo 88 that year was this huge metal rod, for want of a better word. You know, it's a giant phallus. And what was supposed to happen after World Expo 88 was that this giant metal structure was supposed to be shipped over to Tokyo for their Disneyland over there. And Stefan, who we all know in Queensland as a very much-loved hairdresser and entrepreneur, he has speedboats as well. He was so in love with this structure and so didn't want to see it gone that he acquired it. And he placed it where it is now in South Brisbane near Stefan's headquarters. And he made the very tip of this, you know, this metal structure a rainbow, which is, you know, his logo, and inadvertently, I guess, made it into a beacon of gay pride in the city as well. And so it's always been this thing, and I remembered when I would either visit Brisbane and when I first moved to Brisbane in the late 90s that I lived in South Brisbane, in West End specifically, for a very long time, and our view was on the top of Highgate Hill, and you look out onto the skyline, it was so beautiful, and there'd just be this strange rain, this neon rainbow in the middle of the sky. And we all talked about it disparagingly, you know, Stefan's needle, what even is it? It looks so ugly, it's so weird that this is a part of our skyline, that it's so recognisable. It's so shameful in a way. But then I remember when I was working at a bookshop in West End, and it was 2006, and there was a huge storm going on that day, and there were blackouts in certain places, and there were electrical faults going around in certain structures. And one of the structures that had an electrical fault was Stefan's needle. And we looked out and it was on fire. And we all sort of put our hand to our mouths and we said to each other, this is our 9/11. And part of us we were joking about it, like it was so funny seeing Stefan's needle on fire. But there was another part as well, you know, when you didn't see that rainbow in the skyline anymore, it was a very sad sort of omission. And then, of course, when Stefan brought it back and he put the rainbow back up there, it was quite funny the way people talk about it now. Remember when Stefan's needle caught on fire? And now it's got that little story that we all refer back to. It's kitsch, but I think Brisbane always has that slight element of kitsch that we despise and yet love at the same time. Mm.
So, Richard, given the wrecking ball fantasy, where does something like this, where does the tacky and the tawdry and the, you know, odd sit in with your sense of what you do with the wrecking ball or not?
Well, I haven't shared Ben's fondness for Stefan's needle, but not until now, until I realised the whole point of that rainbow up there on the needle was eventually turned West End into a hipster suburb by advertising it as being gay-friendly. I hadn't thought of that until this point in time, but now I understand that. I see a lot of stuff that's been knocked up in Brisbane as a sense of embarrassment over Brisbane's poverty-stricken past. This was a really poor city. It was hit really hard by the Depression of the 1890s and by the 1930s as well. And I sometimes suspect there's an element of... by the time the 60s, 70s, 80s came around, there was an element of shame about that. Oh, this is when we were poor. Now we're a bit more cashed up from mining, so we can afford to bring Jamie Dury and the Backyard Blitz people in and knock up the Meyer Centre. Things like that kind of knocked up thing, like the Meyer Centre, are things that really bother me about Brisbane. The arrogance of a building like that, that sort of is plonked there like a giant fat ass along Elizabeth Street, which has no kind of access to it at all. It forces pedestrians to go up and around it, so there's access to the car park. It's got, as a facade, it's got that salmon pink sort of side wall there with these kind of fake little arches there that are this tawdry, pathetic attempt at decoration. These are really ugly buildings that were sort of put up to make Brisbane look plausible, to sort of scrub over Brisbane's poor past. And, of course, doing so away got rid of a whole lot of stuff that was truly beautiful, and it makes me feel terribly sad. There are things like City Hall in Brisbane, which I think are just fantastic. I love City Hall. It's a beautiful, I think it's a very beautiful building, and kind of nutty as well, that, Greco-Roman kind of facade at the front there, and the columns, and then it's sort of a bit like the Albert Hall inside, and in front of it is a row of palm trees, and it's kind of crazy and lovely. So what do? In order to gussy that up, we roll out the King George Square development. I can't find anyone in the Brisbane City Council who wants to take ownership of that. Once it was done, they all step away and went, oh yeah, it didn't quite pan out, did it, really? And it really looks like that moment in The Simpsons when Marge Simpson's been arrested and Bart's in charge of the housework and his solution is to put every bit of junk under the living room rug. That's what King George Square looks like at the moment. Sort of rolling bumps where you get entrance into the King George bus station there. It's sort of put there and it's all kind of a bit sad and forlorn. So I see this kind of cringy attempt at gussying up the city that's happened in the last 30 years or so. And most of it's just awful. It's terrible and sad and it looks embarrassed about the kind of place Brisbane is. And Brisbane's an amazing place. Its climate is extraordinary. We live in this place where the weather inspires fear in people like me who haven't lived here for very long all the time. It's so big. It's so widescreen. And so little of the architecture of our city seems to even acknowledge that. And consequently, we have a CBD that really looks like a whole lot of other places. It could be Stuttgart, it could be Houston, it could be Calgary, it could be, 20 different anonymous, bland cities with that same international style of architecture. Now, you do see glorious exceptions to it, and a lot of them are dotted around here in Southbank. The building we're in, I think, is one of the most beautiful buildings in Australia, the State Library. I want to see a new kind of modern Queensland form of architecture that embraces the climate, that offers shade, that offers breezeways, that suits the climate, that is a kind of a modern expression of the place we live in and speaks of the place. I want to see much more of that rather than the bland international pap that's been put up there.
You're listening to Big Ideas on RN and online with a discussion about heritage. How do we define it? And why does heritage matter? You can tweet us at RN Big Ideas. Your guests tonight, ABC broadcaster Richard Feidler, columnist at the Courier Mail, Kathleen Noonan, memoirist and journalist Benjamin Law, and feminist and writer Dale Spender. Tonight's discussion is moderated by RN's Kate Evans.
Well, there are so many different ways and different debates about how either spaces, places or other forms of storytelling might address those gaps and those questions and the hidden spaces and so on. And so I'm wondering, just to bring Dale back into the discussion, if where things like quotas fit in, where if we need to be formal in some way about addressing those gaps and those hidden parts of the stories. Is that what does it, or do we need to be more adventurous than that?
Well, I believe in quotas. 50% male. I think that would be ideal. 50% female principals on boys' schools. 50% male. I think quotas could be an admirable target for women to achieve in terms of equality. I mean, that's a bit facetious, but the way quotas are used at times, if you say 50% of women and people make some sort of comment about that means you get, you know, ineffectual people or incompetent people and they're there just because they're women. Well, there are a lot of blooming men that are there because there are men. You know, you have to rethink some of these things. But coming back to your, you know, notion about King George Square. I suddenly realised this afternoon, you know, how many monuments are there for women? I mean, seriously, how many do you know? And if they are, they're stylised things of, you know, Britannia or something like that, but actually commemorating achievements by women, there are very, very few. But Emma Miller was one of them. And I contacted Louise this afternoon and said, is Emma Miller still in King George Square? Because that's where I saw her a long time ago, but I don't remember seeing her recently. And Louise said, oh yeah, she's still around, but she's been moved to the side a bit. And I thought, women's history, you know? There you are, mainstream, middle of the square, and then bit by bit, off to the side, round the back, in the basement. It's absolutely, absolutely planned. Now, one of the things I know about is the cliffs, the Kangaroo Point cliffs. And I don't know how many people here might know that those cliffs were quarried by convict women. And one of the things that I'd like to see would be a sort of light show along there of all those women quarrying those cliffs that no one could ever ignore and it wouldn't go away. That would be one of my quotas, that we could, with the digital age, make much more of what women's achievements are. We could compensate for some of the loss. I know you said that about digital and, you know, it's all be on virtual reality, etc. I think we've got lots of opportunities to recreate some of our heritage in lots of ways. I mean, maybe we could even have some sort of virtual reality of what Brisbane might have looked like and to actually imaginatively work out what was there and how we could alert people to what, you know, digital's about. There are layers behind layers behind layers. We could start thinking about the layers behind things and not just the surface of things.
You were talking about celebrating things, but if we're talking about heritage and history, it's not all celebratory, is it? And
no.
Kathleen, as people have been talking to you about these stories, and we've talked about it before as well, there are really tough stories out there too that we need to address. Institutional stories, stories of loss, stories of, you know, domestic violence, stories of homes for people with disabilities. Where do they fit into this story?
I think when a family or a city or a nation, it shows great maturity when you can not cringe away from the really ugly stories and the uncomfortable stories. I remember being in someone's home when there was a removalist working there, and we were having afternoon tea, there was cake on the table, and I said, help yourself. And he snatched a bit and stood behind a wall to eat it so the other men couldn't see him. It was quite childlike, quite furtive. And I said, oh, you must come from a big family or went to boarding school. Because I came from a big family, went to boarding school, and that's how you got cake. And he said, no, I was in an orphanage. I was taken from my mother, who was deemed to be mentally ill, and I went to Nearcole. I don't know if many people know about Nearcole, outside Rockhampton. Children were taken there and starved and beaten and abused. They certainly weren't loved and taken care of. And some of those stories have come out with things like the Ford Inquiry. But I remember later on I contacted this guy, this is about going back about 15 years, and he said, oh, on my file that I got from the government, it said that I was given chemotherapy and these other drugs. And he said, I was never sick, I didn't have cancer, why was I given these drugs? And at the time I didn't really explore that with him. But in recent years I've heard other stories of people who said they were experimented on in Nearcole. They were given vaccines before they were released on the public. They were given cancer drugs. So to me, they're hidden stories which we haven't really addressed. And big institutions like churches and governments, they say, yes, we want to acknowledge your story and then we want it to be in the past. But, you know, you've got to hear the ugliness of the stories, and those stories have to go on into the future. They've got to be told because they're part of who we are.
Can I just say, I think celebrating heritage is a bad idea. I think it inevitably leads to kitsch. Milan Kundera's famous book, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, was about this ongoing struggle. This is something I think that Dale was touching on and got me thinking, hearing what you were saying about the author who we've completely forgotten, clearly. What a struggle it was in Czechoslovakia during the communist years there to remember things that the regime didn't want people to remember. And the struggle that it was to secretly and furtively make sure things were remembered that needed to be remembered and not to be officially forgotten. And it seems to have happened here without any need for that kind of totalitarianism in Queensland. And that's what heritage is, I think. It's a struggle to remember, not to celebrate. I mean, it's too complex to go hooray at that. But these are things that need to be remembered, the things that Dale's talking about, the I mean, I didn't know there were women convicts that quarry that. Yeah, I mean, you're just, my mind is seriously being blown, but here you say that. I'm dying to find out what that story is. There are great stories, and stories hold many, many, many things in them. And part of it are things to feel like, things you want to celebrate, other things that you want to recoil in horror from. But they're kind of a bundle of a whole lot of different emotions. But when you sort of want to do the celebration thing, you get caught up with that kind of really creepy Queensland exceptionalism sometimes, which holds that people instantly become more virtuous once they cross the border and become better at football, across the Tweed, that kind of thing, which, you know. But I think the idea is to remember, isn't it? That's what we're talking about. Isn't that the point of heritage?
Well, and to be fair, to when you actually look at the things that are on the heritage list, there are extraordinary stories. I mean, like the lazarette at Peel Island, where people with leprosy were taken, and then in 1940, all the Aboriginal inmates were sent up to Phantom Island, which I think is now on the heritage register as well. Even given that so much of that heritage has also been about sites of tourism, when you head from Brisbane to North Stradbroke Island and you land at Dunwich, the whole town of Dunwich was a benevolent asylum with 1,000 people there in 1900. And I know that's recognised by the Heritage Act, but I guess the next question is how much it's recognised on a public and popular level, and how much, I guess for those of us who are in the media, how much that storytelling or other inventive ways of dealing with that heritage might be embedded into those stories, so that we don't see the places as objects but as containers for stories in all sorts of ways. But I guess one of the other things that's a sort of tricky one there is who owns those stories and what happens if they become mainstream. So things like the history of gay Brisbane, does it harm that history if it is made sort of popular in a simple way?
I don't think anyone, including a lot of especially young gay people, and this is including myself until recently, know really the story of gay Queensland. And I think partly that's because I'm young, but also partly because it's not told, let alone popularised. And it wasn't until, I mean, we're talking about, what, the 20th anniversary of this act. Well, a few years ago was the 20th anniversary of the decriminalisation of homosexual acts in Queensland. So for Q Weekend, I wrote a story where I profiled different people, prominent gay, lesbian, queer activists during that time, and what was actually going on to push for that legal reform. And one of the people I interviewed was a gentleman named Nick. And Nick was one of the, I forget the exact name of the organisation now, but he was one of the founding people who organised a committee, a group, to actively push for legislative change when it came to this specific law. And as I was talking to him about this history, I knew that something would have had to have happened at some stage for this law to have been changed, but the intense political manoeuvring that was going on was completely new to me, who they had to convince and what sort of discussions were taking place. And beyond that conversation as well were where these meetings were taking place or where people would socialise. They're not places that I necessarily know of. And back then, of course, because it was a criminalised community, it had to be far more underground as well. When I was hearing these stories, it was like, you know, what I imagine the screenwriter for Milk had to do when he was going back and contacting all these people to actually put this puzzle together. And I didn't necessarily get all the pieces, but it was completely new. And I don't think we really have too many public ways of recognising that. I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that the struggle for queer rights isn't over by any means. So there are still fights we have to look forward towards. And I think especially for young people, it can be hard to necessarily engage with the past, especially in a community where it's so fragmented by age as well.
And I was just thinking, Richard, when you're talking about your interest in the World War II history of Brisbane, of course that was a history that included soldiers and sailors dancing cheek to cheek. But it's not as easy to access. And, you know, would that be part of the MacArthur Museum or not?
Absolutely. And, you know, and more than that, my understanding is, and I could be wrong about this, but the stories I've heard indicate that this whole part of Brisbane was kind of like the Casbah of Australia, essentially, during those war years. African-American soldiers were not allowed into the CBD. I'm right in thinking that, aren't I? So there was a kind of boundary drawn. So I hear stories of, like, nightclubs that were set up here in South Brisbane, jazz nightclubs. I don't know how true that is, but I've heard some reports. You probably know much more about this than I do, Kate. But it's kind of cool to walk down and imagine all this happening and imagine what it's like for, you know, Brisbane girls, and the men are off at war, they're teenagers, they dress up. And they're dancing with an African-American in a nightclub in Brisbane. Man, I mean, that's stories that come from that are amazing. You know, painting seams, you know, pantyhose seams and down their legs with pencils and that kind of thing. Those kinds of stories ought to be the social histories, the culture that kind of exploded here when the city, I don't know, double, triple, quadrupled in size, when it was the kind of general headquarters for the prosecution of the war in the Pacific for some years as it was.
I like that idea of having to address what's missing, what's absent, those places that have been knocked down or have disappeared or where there are only traces left. How do we reanimate them? Dale, you mentioned the digital possibilities. Are there other ways of reanimating these, the places that have disappeared, the ones that can never be memorialised in a conventional way? What do we do?
I don't think heritage is necessarily material. I'd call myself a knowledge feminist. My motto for, you know, 50 years of my life has been, don't cry, do research. And I confronted the notion that, you know, when I was growing up and my mother said to me in exasperation one day, you tell me who you want to be like and I'll help you. And I said, well, I don't want to be like you. That was all your friends. That was the starting point. And then we went through everybody we knew, and there's nobody that I wanted to be like. I didn't know anybody who lived a life like I have lived. I didn't know anyone. I knew that you could be a school teacher, a nurse, a secretary, or a hairdresser. And I said to Mum, I think I probably need to be a hairdresser because all the hairdressers I know are their own bosses and that everyone else works for a man. I'd at least worked that out. But she said I couldn't be a hairdresser. I had to stay on at school. So then we went to literature and we went to people like, you know, Anna Karenina, dead. Emma Woodhouse, you know, married Mr. Knightley, lived happily ever after. Hoax. All of these sorts of things. And my mother finally turned to me and said, what you want doesn't exist. And I was 14 years of age. There was not a single role model that she could point me to in my life. And I certainly didn't know at 14, but by the time I was about 25 and the women's movement had started, I started to think about, is it true that women have been on this earth all this time and we've never done anything important unless we were a bloody queen or something like that, the Queen Victoria or Queen Catherine or something? Have we never done anything at all? And if we haven't done anything, does it mean we have to start now? But what if we have done wonderful things and I don't know about them? And one of the things I decided to do was to write a history of women's ideas. And I went along to my publisher, Routledge, in London, and said to Norman Franklin, who was the publisher, terribly, terribly proper, I don't know how ever he published me, and who said to me, book of women ideas, be very small. It's 800 pages. But it didn't, and it's all these women who achieved all these wonderful things. Now, I know about that, and it changed my life. You know, and I stopped saying things like, behind every great man, there's a woman. I'd say, you know, behind every great man, there's, you know, someone who's appropriated the resources of a woman and used them to his own ends, etc., etc. I also know that once you understand some of women's history and the heritage and the stories, and I think women's history, you see, and women's lives in lots of ways, it's about so much silence. I mean, I just look at domestic violence even, and it's still so much silence, that things that can't be mentioned, things that can't be talked about, that are everyday realities. And I think that we have to sort of break that silence, come out and say, it's not necessarily to celebrate, but it releases things and you understand, you know, there have been so many fantastic, wonderful women have done such marvellous things but have ended up like Emma Miller, you know, off the stage and round the corner and down the basement and they've got flooded. So the end. I'm not all that keen on the building, so I do think one that appeals to me immensely, this is very naughty, you might have to cut this out, is what was once the Grand Temple of the Masonic Lodge in Washington. It's now the Women's History Museum. Now I can't think of anything more appropriate for a building than the Women's History Museum. And it was a beautiful, beautiful building. So I'd go for that one as Women's Heritage. But a lot of the things I think are intangible and change the way you view the world. And women do grow up still with so few role models, but at least there are a few more than there were. You know, we do have a woman Prime Minister who uses the word misogyny correctly.
But, Kathleen, the world, there are some aspects of the world certainly that are changing for us and for our children. So the other question about heritage is how we collect, preserve, deal with the contemporary world and how we deal with it into the future. For you, is that about everyday life? Is it for sort of daily lived experience or the sort of grand sense of the state or the nation? What is it that we need to be dealing with now?
I couldn't legislate or even begin to comment on something like that. I think heritage and a sense of origins and achievements and some pride, even in things that have gone wrong, enhances your life and gives you a generosity of spirit that you don't have without a heritage. If it's taken away from you, if you don't have something to refer to, there's a sense. I mean, I still have a sense of loss about my past, no matter how many books I write and how much research I do. There's always a sense of something missing and stories not told. But I think if anybody tried to specify what you should know and what you shouldn't know, I mean, hardly anyone would ever end up with the diet that I've had of different women and the ones that I think are fantastic and the ones that I'm not all that keen on. I think it's very difficult to specify anything. I think you make the most available of what you can with the least value judgments, as long as it's 50% women.
I guess I'm just wondering briefly from the rest of the panel, if this is leaving you feeling optimistic about our engagement with the past and with what we might be moving into the future with, or still ready for that wrecking ball?
I think Brisbaneites in particular have seen a lot destroyed, and we've realised that if you sit on the sidelines, things go overnight. So I think there's that sense of that you need to mobilise when you feel strongly about something. You need to think to yourself, I would chain myself to that building. I would chain myself to that site so it doesn't get destroyed. And I feel that way about a building like the Morton Rubber building at the Gabba. She's a beautiful old building over there, and the Cantilever Stadium has grown over her. She fronts Logan Road and Vulture Street, and it's grown over her like this sort of 6-foot-tall hulking grandson, and she's the little grandma. And she's a fabulous old building, and she hasn't been overdeveloped, which is another thing we do in Brisbane. We take heritage buildings and we renovate them and shine them up till they're just perfect. And I don't think old buildings should be just perfect. So she's got this sort of creamy blue peeling paint with these sort of crazy old masonry balls on top. That was a hotspot, a commercial hotspot in the Gabba Five Ways when she was built in the 1890s. But all that time, she's remained something that was used by business. And today, she's got a very interesting owner who will only sort of have tenants that he likes, whether you come to him with money or not. So he's got a very eclectic group of tenants who are very loyal to the building. And when you go downstairs into the cellar, because the Gabba Five Ways, that area was like a very ancient waterway where lots of indigenous tribes came because it was rich with food. So you go down into the cellars of these buildings and they're cold as pewter. And you can touch these huge sort of beams down there. And to me, they're about our links with land as much as our links with buildings. So I'm optimistic that we've got a sense of what we've lost. And you know, we're gonna fight really hard in the future.
I'm not optimistic at all, I'm afraid. I'm not at all. I think an interesting example to look at is to look at the cities that directly to the south of us, Sydney and Melbourne, and the different approaches they've taken. Sydney's been largely disastrous, I think, and we seem to be going down that Sydney road. Melbourne, on the other hand, went through an awful economic collapse at the beginning of the 1990s. I was there. I was living in there at the time, and Something happened then. There was a new government with a strong planning minister, with a kind of sense of aesthetic and a sense that need, and perhaps the city government, the Melbourne City Council also, had an idea that the whole standard of the city needed to lift. I don't know if you remember what Melbourne CBD was like 25 years ago. It was an awful place. It was perhaps the ugliest CBD in Australia. But careful planning and an interesting approach to heritage, which was to not just over-tidy it up like you're saying, Kathleen, which I think is quite right, but to build other things around it that talk to it and interface with it in new ways and play around with it, have turned Melbourne into a wholly different city. Part of that, too, was attracting residents into the CBD, which then brought local 24-hour businesses. It's transformed the place. Melbourne's such a pleasure to walk through now. It's an absolute joy. In Brisbane, well, you know, we had the Regent Theatre. There was a strong campaign by a lot of people to save it, and good on them for trying that. But in the end, there was kind of, well, the powers that be went, well, look, it's going to have to be turned into a corporate something. And that's pretty much what happened. Nothing was really done to try and preserve that. And the kind of approach that we've got at the moment is a kind of tepid, well, maybe we could have some Melbourne laneways, maybe, with an upward inflection at the end of that voice. That's where we are now, I think. There's not the environment which places talented, young, innovative architects and designers in and around the CBD to sustain and create a new urban environment, which is what's definitely required.
A new urban environment, Benjamin, with maybe flaming Stephen's needles all through it?
That's right, just flames and rainbows everywhere. Just turn the entire place into a permanent pride parade. No, my preoccupation's probably, as a writer, less to do with physical structures and preserving them just simply for the sake of preserving them. I guess I'm more interested in excavation and unearthing. So if we see a building, I mean, how are we even supposed to know it's significant unless we know the stories behind it? And when we talk about history, in every city, there is always a certain account of history that's always privileged, and it's usually a male account, and it's usually a male account of a certain class and positioning as well. But there's all these parallel histories running alongside it that are just as legitimate and important to tell. There's women's history, there's black history, there's queer history, there's Asian Australian history, there's all types of different stories that are just as significant to all these different communities as well. And I guess taking it back to the personal as well, I'm the child of Asian migrants, Chinese migrants who came out of Hong Kong at a time where a lot of people were moving out of Hong Kong in the late 70s and throughout the 80s as well. But there have been different influxes of migration into Australia, but I didn't necessarily know about them until I talked to Chinese Australian people of a different generation who had the most ochre accents in far north Queensland. And if you go to, say, a performance or an exhibition of William Yang's, for instance, and he guides you through all these stories, and that's the structure where this happened to my family when they arrived at this time, it's suddenly imbued with importance. You know, it might be a hideous structure, it might be the most ghastly architectural abomination, but if we know the stories behind it, I think that's a far more interesting approach.
That was memoirist and journalist Benjamin Law, together with columnist at the Courier-Mail, Kathleen Noonan, Richard Feidler, ABC broadcaster, and feminist and writer Dale Spender. They were discussing the value of heritage as part of the Out of the Port series presented by the State Library of Queensland in partnership with the Department of Environment and Heritage Protection. And the discussion was moderated by RN's Kate Evans.